Now moving on from the history to the present. The federal court case that dealt a blow to the Indian Child Welfare Act earlier this month was entitled Brackeen versus Zinke. The immediate facts of the case was the status of a 2-year-old Cherokee and Navajo boy who a white couple wanted to adopt and a Navajo family was also willing to adopt. The judge, federal judge Reed O'Connor, a Republican appointee, said that in this case, the Indian Child Welfare Act could not prevail and send the child to the Navajo family because he determined it was a quote-unquote race-based statute. As you're about to hear, this is an incredibly important distinction because defenders of Indian law say it is based on tribal membership and tribal sovereignty, not on race. If courts start adopting a race-based analysis, that could weaken much more than just rules for adoption of Native children. Joining us to go into that is Matthew Fletcher. He is a citizen of the Grand Traverse Band of Ottawa and Chippewa Indians, also director of the Indigenous Law and Policy Center at Michigan State University. Thank you for joining us.
Hello. Thank you.
Why don't you start by explaining the legal consequences of interpreting this as a race-based law?
Well, if you take the court at its word in that all statutes that have the word Indian in them are subject to strict scrutiny, then pretty much everything in Title 25 of the U.S. Code is subject to attack. Possibly, other than the Indian Child Welfare Act, the first thing to go or to be seriously challenged is the Major Crimes Act, which authorizes the federal government to prosecute, quote, Indians in Indian country for federal crimes. So that includes more than just mere tribal members. It includes people who are Indian and meet some other criteria besides tribal membership. However, I think this case could be limited, not in a way that would be satisfactory to most tribes, but it could be limited to non-tribal members. So the court seems to be very concerned about Indian children who are not yet members of Indian tribes and saying that the act as applied to them should be construed under the strict scrutiny analysis. But for all others,
so the distinction here is between people who are eligible to be members of tribes but not enrolled as members of those tribes and people who are enrolled as members of the tribes.
That's the easy distinction, yes. That would be the easier distinction.
Got it. Why is that an operative distinction for a 2-year-old? It's not like they choose whether or not they're enrolled.
Well, it's a terrible distinction for a 2-year-old. Let me give you my own family's example. My children are eligible for membership at several tribes here in Michigan, and my wife and I probably waited close to a year before we chose to enroll our children, our first child, in one of the tribes. And for anybody else to say that our child who is eligible at several different tribes was not an Indian person is really quite offensive. So, you know, there has to be a political relationship between Indian people who are not tribal members and certain tribes. Maybe it's just one, but there has to be that political relationship, even if they are not actually enrolled. It's sort of a false dichotomy.
So the interesting thing that put this case on our radar is that there were celebratory press releases about this federal court's decision from some really well-financed litigation shops, including the Goldwater Institute. Their mm-hmm. principal patron are the Mercer families, who are also big backers of Donald Trump. And they filed an amicus brief in this case and apparently have been filing or joining cases like this targeting the Indian Child Welfare Act for years. What do they get? Why do they care about adoption rules for Native children?
That's a really good question. I wish I knew the answer. They'll tell you it's because they care about Indian kids, but those organizations have never done before anything to help Indian kids and are certainly not doing anything now. The comparison is, say, KC Family Programs, which dedicates an enormous amount of money to helping Indian families and actually all families avoid having their kids taken away through the foster care process and the foster care system. Goldwater and the other groups that are part of this have done absolutely zero for any children other than try to strip them from the protections of the Indian Child Welfare Act. My speculation is, to be frank, that quietly there's a recognition that the private adoption market is a $16 billion market. You can Google that. It's in the financial trade papers. It's a growing market. Just a few years ago, it was just $14 billion. Every adoption costs on average between $45,000 and $50,000 in fees that go to lawyers and adoption agencies. I'm not saying adoption is a terrible thing, and it's important to have that outlet. But the financial incentives to move a kid in foster care from foster care into the private adoption market are really enormous. And the private adoption entities and markets and representatives have been on the forefront of attacking the Indian Child Welfare Act since the legislative history, the years leading up to the enactment of the statute. It was the adoption agencies that did everything they could to stop ICWA. And I think that that's still happening.
ICWA is the Indian Child Welfare Act. Just say that for our listeners' benefit. I guess the other question I had is, if the courts start tossing out areas of Indian law on the basis that they're race-based and not membership-based, does that precedent throw out, engage other really big financial interests? Like what about the natural gas and oil and mining resources that are managed on behalf of Native tribes?
Absolutely. There's a whole entire body of law, again, mostly in Title 25 of the U.S. Code, as I mentioned before, that relates to how Indian tribes have land, what we call trust land. Land that's actually owned by the United States in trust for tribes, and that's federal land, but it's really reservation land. So tribes that own that land, they get to regulate the activities that occur on that land, including oil and gas, mineral extraction, et cetera, et cetera. Now, there has been a concerted effort over the last few decades to try to undo or limit that kind of land and to limit the acquisition of new trust lands, and also to undermine the statute itself, to say it's unconstitutional for the United States to acquire land and trust for Indian tribes. Now, if that's the case, and trust land isn't really trust land, it's just regular fee land, then that completely undermines Indian tribes and the federal government as its backer in terms of their ability to regulate on reservation, on trust land, oil and gas, mineral extraction. And, you know, think about there's actually a case pending in the Supreme Court right now. It's a death penalty case out of Oklahoma. And the parties arrayed there will give you a sense of how this works. If the guy on death row wins, that means the state didn't have jurisdiction over this on reservation land. And it also means that the oil and gas industry that on Oklahoma that is doing work and business on reservation land within the reservation boundaries, but not on trust land, they will have to be regulated. They could be regulated by the federal government and the tribe. So oil and gas has enormous financial interests in having states regulate them rather than the federal government or Indian tribes, who tend to have much higher regulatory burdens imposed on natural resource extractors. The other place where this shows up is gaming. Donald Trump had a lot of gaming interests over the years, and in the 90s and the aughties, so to speak. He was heavily involved in trying to limit tribal interests in Indian gaming on and off reservation. And there have been conservative organizations that have attacked the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act as being an unconstitutional race-based statute. And none of those have been successful yet either, but you can imagine how non-Indian entities and also state government entities interested in gaming would like to limit the scope of a statute like that.
And that's not just about competition with other non-Indian casinos. It's also about how much money from casino-owning tribes goes into Democratic coffers.
Yeah, that's obviously a very interesting point.
Matthew Fletcher, thank you so much for speaking to us.
Yep.
Matthew Fletcher is a citizen of the Grand Traverse Band of Ottawa and Chippewa Indians, director of the Indigenous Law and Policy Center at Michigan State University.